the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Kalabian, and today we'll be interviewing Ed, the CEO and founder of Anatha, a UBI platform built on the blockchain. So thanks so much for being here. And before we get started, I just wanted to say my app, UBDI, is now available on the App Store, Google Play, and the web at app.ubdi.com. We added a bunch of social features, so you can now share your crypto trades, you can talk with other members, and you can stream and view other people's trades in real time, which we think is pretty cool. So check out the new experience. It'd be a huge help to me if you could do that. And without further ado, we'll get started.
I used to work in the finance industry ahead of the big collapse in 2008. And I was more or less working in the belly of the beast. And I got to see it up close and personal. And when the 2008 crash happened, which coincidentally was the same thing that birthed Bitcoin, right? I was left destitute and kind of had my whole life turned upside down and, you know, felt really destroyed by that. And a few years later, when I discovered what Bitcoin was and realized that it was designed to tackle the exact thing that had harmed me so grievously, I realized that, this is something that I was going to be really passionate about, really cared about. So, and I realized it solved a lot of big problems, right? So for my part, since I bought my first Bitcoin very early on, it was like 14 cents. And, you know, before anyone goes and pats me on the back for that, I lost it all because I didn't understand private key management, as is the case with many of our early adopters, right?
Yep.
By 2013, I was all in. I went full time. I decided to give my entire life to crypto. I realized that it was the most important invention in my lifetime, certainly, and perhaps in modern civilization. And as a result, I've given it all my wherewithal, all my time, all my energy, all my inputs, and all my capital. And subsequently, now I am the CEO of a technology company that is doing quite well. We are servicing some interesting clients as of late. We just finished one of the more successful liquidity offerings in market history back on October 1st when we deployed our mainnet, and that went really well, and that ensured a certain degree of success for our organization. But we're certainly not, just leaning back on our laurels. I think the thing that really stands apart and the thing that is congruent both for my career and my company is that my main focus has been on how to solve big problems, specifically how to solve poverty. And that's where we sort of dovetail into this universal basic income discussion. I believe that UBI is the answer to a lot of our problems, but I believe that the way it's been promoted for the most part is unsustainable. Usually they want to create UBI through some taxation or some other form of extractive qualities. I think we could create self-sustaining UBIs. So Anatha is an example of that, and Project Anatha is designed to do exactly that. It's an information-based regenerative economy. So it has some of the shape and functionality of a UBI in that money is going to end users on a regular basis, but it's not built from an extractive process. It's actually built from a regenerative one, in that the user's own inputs are what is generating the value for that UBI, right? And I think one of the things that people are going to have to realize is that now that information is more valuable than oil, we are essentially gold mines, right? We're the ones producing the data and information. We're the ones doing the inputs. So it just makes logical sense to me to include human beings in on the process of when capital is created or when value is extracted, to just make sure that some of it is going back to them. And in Anatha's case, we're giving 50% back to every end user in our ecosystem. So it's a really exciting experiment. A lot of people are getting it, sort of grokking to it and realizing that it has some teeth to it. The part that most people don't realize, and this is kind of my magic sauce, is that we're taking everything we're doing and white labeling it and offering it to other clients or other entities or organizations that want it. And normally that means we were going outside of Project Anatha, but what I've done is I've managed to loop them all in, and all of them feed into the same economic torus, the same UBI essentially. And that's going to be really exciting. So it means every time I close a deal, it strengthens that process, right? And so I'm building what I consider a fractal economy, in that each of these projects are independent, but all of them feed into each other. And if successful, I believe I could create the world's first self-sustaining UBI at the global scale. And so that's Anatha's ambition, and we're on our way.
Well, that's a lot, and that's great in a nutshell. I mean, it's really interesting you mentioned, you know, 2007, 2008. I feel like that was sort of the, you know, culmination of a lot of things that brought people to the realization of what Bitcoin can be. In my case, like, you know, my father had passed away in 2007 in the summer. We took our whole life insurance money, stuck it in the market, tanked 50%. And I just couldn't believe, like, you know, there's one thing after another. I was like, how is this guy who is his whole job to figure this out, can't figure this out? And I just had to learn everything I could at that point. And the more you learn, the more you realize it's, you know, sort of a rigged game.
We call it a racket. Yeah.
I know, everyone loves to talk about Ponzi schemes, and it's like everything's a Ponzi scheme. You know, Bitcoin, of course it is. Everything is. But it just depends who's the first one out and who knows when it's ending, really.
Well, like, the definition of a Ponzi is ultimately that the only way to make money is for other people to put money in. And everything should have Ponzi-like qualities, I guess, that quality of, like, inputs and outputs. But you could escape the Ponzi scheme label if there's actual utility or function, right? Like, if the thing actually is useful, then it's not a Ponzi, right? Yeah. The hallmark of Ponzi's is that they're useless. they don't help anyone, right?
Exactly. And I think, you know, with what we're doing here, I guess it'd be interesting to understand, you know, how you think about UBI. Do you think about it as something that, you know, needs to be earned? Is there some inherent transfer of value, or is it something that, you know, I think, I guess, at the private scale, is it something that needs to be funded and needs to be, you know, sort of a nonprofit, or is it something that has an economic backing behind it? Is it something that'll work in conjunction with governments or on its own?
I mean, first off, I think it has to come from the private sector. I don't think governments will ever pull it off successfully. I think they will attempt to do so, but mostly governments only know how to do things with extractive properties. They know how to, like, tax you and then give the money away, and that's not regenerative. In fact, the more you tax something, the more you're disincentivizing it, right? Yeah. So it's like, over time, that will just wither and die. Now, I think universal basic income has to be based off of an older philosophical process, which is the intrinsic value of human beings. You see, it's not money that's valuable in an economy, it's the people. And the only reason the money is valuable is because other people will give you something, some goods or services for that money. And we sort of forget that. We fixate on the unit of account, not realizing that it's people that are valuable. So my systems design just remembers that. It remembers that it's the inputs and the people that are valuable. And thankfully, there's something in computer science called Metcalfe's Law, which it solidifies that. It's proof positive that human beings are valuable, right? It's like, if you just put more people in an economy and connect them better, that ultimately that economy will grow and be worth something. And as evidenced by the market cap of every cryptocurrency in the market, right? That's Metcalfe's Law made manifest, right? So that's my basic core philosophy, is that it's the people that are valuable. Well, if they're what's valuable, we should be building in our systems to honor that. And I think UBI is just an expression of that. How do you bring humans into the economy? Well, it helps if you pay them, right? It helps if you give them an incentive to be part of your economy. Now, that said, I think like a standard base level UBI is certainly acceptable, but we also need to make room for upward mobility and ambition and growth. And so I design systems that have a base level where everyone has sort of like shared outcomes while still opening the door for individual wealth and individual ambition, right? So, and what does that look like in a system like mine? Well, it means more inputs. It means if you're, for example, in the social media platform I'm going to be deploying next year, if you're creating more content and your content is viewed by more people and engaged with by more people, you will naturally make more money. Of course, in doing so, you're also making more money for your community. All right. So it's the thing about shared incentives. They don't have to be completely level, right? We could have shared incentives of which everyone's benefiting from everyone's activity, and yet at the same time, the most productive members of society can still benefit more. Right. And so I think people sometimes think it's like either or. Either you make this level playing field and everyone gets the same amount of money no matter what, or it's wild capitalism, right? And you know, someone has to be emperor while everyone else is poor. And those two extremes seem to be the only things that our societies or our governments seem to be able to envision. And I think that you need both. You need the ability for people to have ambition and have growth and create environments in which that's totally possible. And yet at the same time, you raise the lowest rung of the ladder so that they're not starving, right? Yeah. My ambition isn't that we all become kings. It's that maybe people shouldn't starve to death before they reach puberty. But maybe that's not the best economic outcome we can hope for as a civilization, yeah. Right?
No, absolutely. You know, it's how we distribute the labor and how we can get people into a position where they can work together and put their labor into the most efficient process. So do you imagine that, you know, people will have their incentives weighted by the value they contribute to the system? So is it, you know, kind of like you said, is it the wild capitalist system, or are we just giving everyone sort of the same?
I believe it's both. I believe, yes, it's weighted based on your economic output and your value, but your contribution will be equivalent to that as well. So while you're making more money from your efforts, you're also generating more money for the overall economy for your efforts, and everyone shares in the latter part, right? So that's kind of my system's design. I also think if you're controlling the inflation and distribution policy of your economy and you're pointing it towards humans, that there'll be a base level there that gives everyone the opportunity to be more productive in the first place, right? Most of the data suggests that if you get people to be above that $2 a day threshold, that they're perfectly capable of becoming middle class on their own and then becoming productive members of society. So what I think we really suffer from now is this situation where some people have the opportunity to say, get the right education or get access to capital or become productive members of society. And some people just don't have that opportunity, even though they have the wherewithal or the sort of physical or mental capabilities of doing so. I simply want to level the playing field on that side, where I want to have as many inputs as possible, because I think ultimately we'll all benefit from that. It's, all the productivity that we leave in developing nations, for example, for people, young entrepreneurs who can't build businesses or who can't get access to capital, that's a net loss to the rest of us as well. And I think people really need to start wrapping their heads around that we all benefit when other people succeed. Right, mm-hmm. That we don't have to live in this sort of extractive mindset where in order for someone to succeed, millions of people have to fail. And I think that's an old paradigm. And I think that's a second industrial revolution paradigm, mm-hmm. where they're wrestling with things which are called rivalrous goods. Right, in order for me to have the gold, you need to not have the gold, and therefore wealth is a very limited perspective thing. Versus the information age, in which it's based off of information and digital assets and digital services and goods. If I share the information with you, it doesn't lose its value. In fact, I increased its value, right? So we want to share it as much as possible, right? The more people we share cryptocurrency with, the more we all benefit, right? There's not a loss to us. So I think that kind of perspective is what's going to mark the next economic output, the next sort of economic wave. And I think the older generations are going to struggle with that. I think they're going to continue to struggle with it. It's been one of the central hallmarks of my own career is I go into meetings with people who would like to participate in cryptocurrency somehow, and yet they don't seem to understand that their way to make money is to give some of it away, right? They feel like they need to hold it all very close to their chest. And of course, those projects don't do very well and they don't never get off the ground. But the projects and the economic ecosystems that are the most generative, the most giving, I believe will be the market leaders. And Anatha is kind of a first mover in that space, where we're like, hey, it's not enough to just create a really secure cryptocurrency, right? You need to make one that has an inflation and distribution policy that is elegant and includes all the different things you need to have a healthy economy. If you look at the top 20 cryptos right now, almost all of them have the same inflation and distribution policy. They all invest in one thing, infrastructure. Right. And what we're saying is, like, if you built a civilization that way, you'd have like really nice roads, but nothing else. Right. So what we say is, sure, some should go to the infrastructure, but you also need some for user adoption, which is one of the big problems of crypto. You need another one for ongoing development, which is a big one. Right. If you studied the track record of what happened with Bitcoin, one of the attack vectors is that most of the developers weren't owning Bitcoin. They weren't making Bitcoin by participating in the ecosystem because the inflation and distribution policy didn't consider them. Right. So we need to make systems that do consider them. Anatha has that. I created a layer zero smart contract that has these kind of elegant distributions. More importantly, I created a governance module, which allows the end users to change that governance contract, to alter it and say, well, yes, we're putting 25% towards development now, but we want to put 35% or 40%, right? That's fine. And we want the development to be split up into these groups. Or the ones I'm really excited about is when you start to see ethos-led economies, where imagine if all of the users of Bitcoin could just say, yeah, we want 10% of all newly created Bitcoin to go towards removing the plastic from the Pacific ire. Right? Yeah. Like, why wouldn't we choose that? Right? These are things that we align with. And these are the kind of things we wish our government would do, right? But we can't get them to do it. We don't have a voice. So I think Tim Draper is right in that, like, economic ecosystems are going to be competing for user input, for like to join your economy. And I think ethos-led economies are going to be the exact kind of ones that we want to join. So yeah. Most of my work has just been like, how do I create that environment and those tools to make that possible?
Right. Yeah. So do you think there's been sort of like a decoupling of labor and value, and that might be why some of the older folks are having trouble understanding the value and people not really doing anything? You know, they're generating goods that are, you know, hard, not tangible, essentially.
I think they don't understand what labor means in the information age, yeah, right? Yeah. I think content curation, content sharing, content creation, all that stuff is wildly important, right? You're just typing on a keyboard on someone's website is producing metadata that is valuable right now. That is a form of labor, right? Yeah. The problem is we've been giving it away to the large, like, all that labor, if it wasn't valuable, would not have created Google and Facebook. Right? Like, you would have these like large, massive organizations that are titanic in size and wield tremendous power and influence. That's the result of other people's labor. Web 2.0 was about user inputs using their labor to create value for other economies or other platforms. I'm saying, fine, let's continue to do that. Let's just make sure that we're included in on the deal, that when we unpack all this value, when we make the next Google or the next Facebook, that we're included, right? That we get a part of that action. So part of my philosophy is that users are partners, not products. We were the product in Web 2.0. And Web 3.0, we need to be partners. We need to be part of that foundation, right? And that scares the hell out of a lot of people. And certainly it should scare Facebook and Google, because the new paradigm will be like, well, how do we fork Google and just make sure that every time Google makes any money from selling our data and information, that we get an equal portion of that, right?
Yep, exactly. And that's part of what we're trying to do. We're trying to allow people just to import all those ad targeting attributes and everything and just take it, because now they have to give it to you. So you can just kind of take it, which is really neat. How do you think about who sort of gets this first? So would you prefer to take it in the direction of, you know, the US consumer who might have a higher value on average, but the money, $2 a day, is not going to probably be a huge drop in the bucket, versus going to, you know, some part of Asia or Africa or wherever it might be and giving them, you know, something that's more of a sizable amount, but having less potential value behind it?
Well, we're doing it simultaneously, right? We're saying that the use case is different depending on the user, ultimately, right? If you're living on $2 or less a day, that trickle of money is going to be really valuable to you, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're not, that trickle of money is simply a tool that you use to move around in an environment freely, right? And we believe we could create environments or economic ecosystems which are useful for both groups, right? Where for the first world developed nation member, someone like myself is looking at our ecosystem going, wow, look at the interface. Wow. Human readable address, first off, is a big deal. A human readable address I could use to talk to other people in my ecosystem is another big deal. Also, I could get my privacy back. I could live in these environments in which I have some sense of control and a voice. For a first world user, that's very valuable, right? Except those economic inputs and that value is leaking across the whole distributed nation, including people in developing nations. So I think they go hand in hand, and we have initiatives in both. We have strategic partners that are helping us leverage in developing nations, such as I know Henry would love to hear about my friend Henry, who is over at Ghana. He has a cell phone service in which he can make money by giving away free phone service and data, right? So like, he gives you the free phone service and he's making money because, again, proof positive, those inputs
Facebook
are more valuable.
Basics, they're just handing those phones out at this point, right?
Precisely, right? So that's how you get into the developing nations. You just make sure that your application and system is part of that. And that I'm working on strategic partnerships to do exactly that. Now, in developing nations, though, I think it's more of a question about philosophy. It's a question about branding and positioning, right? They'll grok to what's going on. Some people will join just because it's helping developing nations, but others will just want the human readable address. And, you know, my hack is I'm going to throw really exclusive events that you can't get access to without our interface. Like, our tickets are only going to be for sale in our currency. If you want to buy anything at those events, you have to use our currency. If you want to become a vendor at those events, you have to pay for it in our currency, right? And we're going to create our own economic ecosystem that way. And I've seen this before. We've done it with other projects. You could get market penetration that way if you do it properly. Thankfully, the scale that crypto works at allows you to do it really effectively. Like, the cost of throwing an event could be covered by the revenue of the event itself. Therefore, you could have infinite user adoption, right? As long as, like, the event is paying for itself, and I do know how to throw very profitable events, you could just do that ad infinitum, right? Yeah. So it's like, what's your user acquisition? It's like, it makes me money to acquire users. So, you know, I'm going to do that forever. So we have two different strategies for that. I think between strategic partnerships, and again, this is part of my fractal economy idea. I don't need them to be using my interface to be a user in my system. I could give you all the technology. I could build a custom user interface. I could help another project launch and allow them their own independence and allow them to do everything you want to do. And yet their users can be mine and my users can be theirs. I think that level of interoperability, again, is one of those things that confuses the old generation, because in order for like Facebook to have users, you need to not be on any system.
Yeah,
right?
So you're not fighting for attention in the same way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this was part of the early crypto thing. It's like, we're not competing with each other. It's us versus the legacy system, not us versus us, right?
Yeah.
And interoperability allows for that in a more like granular, direct way now. So I'm a big interoperability guy. Most of the stuff I'm doing is going to be allow me to operate in other people's ecosystems and help other ecosystems without harming ourselves at all. In fact, it helps us.
So in response to the sort of entrenched players and the institutions, what do you think their response is going to be if this, you know, starts to take off? Do you think they're going to try to, you know, become a bigger part of it? Do you think they'll be supporting it, trying to sponsor it? Are they going to compete? Are they going to be happy that people have more money to spend at their stores and try to find ways to route it into their wallets? You know, what do you think that looks like?
I think it's on a case-by-case basis. I think the smart ones are realizing that, you know, this is inevitable, that you can't close Pandora's box, right? Like, yeah. Non-national digital money is a product. It's out. It's going to be a competitive market. I've been saying for years it will be the most competitive marketplace in the world. And some big players, and I'll say tier two players, like tier two nation states, tier two central banks and retail banks, have been jumping in. I'm talking to a number of them, and they're going to continue to jump in. I think the really big cantankerous ones will always be the last to move. You know, like the United States will probably be the last one to launch a legitimate central bank digital currency, because the leader is always the last to respond,
yeah.
Right? But
Iran stocking up on Bitcoin first, though.
Yeah, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, yeah. Right? All these nations that like are. In the shit house, so to speak, yeah. Right? They're the ones that have the most incentive, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's all about who has the most incentive to move first will move first. And I'm talking to two small European nation states, and we worked out central bank digital currency deals already. And I'm telling them that they need to not make the mistakes of the past and simply try to make digital versions of a normal central bank system, but instead work with a distributed system and make it have some of the qualities of crypto, such as being open and permissionless, and build a legitimate trust network that anyone could audit at any time. And then they'll have a shot at using the advantages of crypto to get around some of their competitors, right? Because if you're a second or third tier bank, you're looking at these behemoths like, how am I supposed to compete, right? And the way is you jump on this fast moving industry. It's the fastest growing industry on the planet every year since it's existed. Anyone who's not involved in it or not, you know, specifically putting all their energy and inputs to it is not paying attention, period, right?
Yep.
So most of the banks I talk to want in, they just don't know how. And that's where people like me come in.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So do you think, you know, fast forward, let's say 20 years and everyone's got their UBI, you know, what do you think the effect is on the American worker? At what level do you think people would be, one, happy or have their basic needs covered, you know, just assuming things are, you know, inflation is what it is now or whatever?
I think we'll see flourishing unlike anything we've ever seen before. If these things actually get to scale and we get our teeth into the market and we have the sort of aggregate effect of like billions of people operating in a system, spreading value globally with one another. For starters, my main goal is to stop the problem of 9 million people dying every year of hunger and hunger-related disease. To me, that is an affront to humanity. It's appalling that we produce more calories than we could consume as a species every day, and yet we let 9 million people die every year of hunger and hunger. That's on a good year, by the way. It's supposedly 18 million this year. There's another 500 million people living in food scarcity right now because of the economic lockdown. The idea that we as educated, you know, functioning human beings would allow that to continue is appalling to me. So most of my work is designed to stop that. And in 20 years, if I haven't stopped that, I'm going to be like raging mad and trying even harder. You know? And so I think that's the first thing. We want to make sure that we're lifting that bottom rung. Now, after that happens, what we're going to see is a move to middle class, similar to what we saw in the United States after World War II, where suddenly there was just more productivity, more entrepreneurs, more economic output, and everyone benefited from that. A robust middle class is the smartest way to design your society. We've seen it over and over. All the economic data is there. That's the best possible outcome for us. And I think if we could do that globally, using distributed nation states, using non-national digital money, that we will see a level of flourishing unlike anything we imagined. And then if you flash forward even further, that ultimately that will lead to us being able to do really amazing things like touch the stars, right? That's really what we're after here, right? We're trying to create efficiencies in our species where we have so much economic output, so much wherewithal, so much creativity, so much engineering and doctors and all that stuff, that doing the really tough stuff, like the really, really, like building a Dyson sphere around the star, around our star, and, you know, going to the next, you know, solar system, like we can start doing that stuff. And that's the stuff that excites me. I think we're laying the groundwork for that now. And I think that's the really, like, sort of sci-fi aspect of crypto, is that it's not just that it fixes some of our economic woes, it's that fixing our economic woes unlocks human potential in a way that we just can't imagine, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what UBI really wants, right? It's about getting everyone on board here, because we need it all. We need all of collective intelligence to tackle these problems, and not doing so is the analogy I always use is we're farmers that only water half our field.
Yeah.
Right? We plant seeds everywhere, but then we only water half the field and we let the other half die. So I'm tired of that. And I think in order to move forward into the future, we need to fix that immediately.
So, I mean, that's, you know, reaching the stars, creating Dyson spheres, that's, you know, that's the hope, right? So what is the alternative? Say all of a sudden, you know, a few big nation states roll this out, they attach a social credit score to it. You know, what are the potential pitfalls if private industry doesn't get it right and it moves towards government?
Well, I mean, if government takes it, I think it depends which governments. You know, the ones more totalitarian leaning will always be a problem. And I don't think I think by their very nature, they can't get it right, though, that the ones that will get it right by their very nature sort of have, you know, a more egalitarian bent to them. You know, it'd be like the Norwegian, the Nordic countries, or, you know, Sweden or Switzerland or someone doing it right. But my real fear is that non-national digital money will destabilize nation states unevenly. And I was part of a think tank in which we called this World War C, World for Currency M3, in which if you were to say, for example, destabilize the U.S. economy, but the People's Bank of China were able to hold on long enough, what you end up with is a shift in the global axis of power, where suddenly China could just encroach on its neighbors freely, right? And that's a very dangerous thing, especially if you're in Taiwan. I also think a nation like, say, Pakistan, if losing control of its money supply, might use its standing army to try to bolster its economy by grabbing resources from nearby neighbors. And in order to do that, it would have to deploy its military. Now, the upside to that is that the cost of the military operation itself would require them to inflate the currency further, and they would perhaps sort of like ring their own death knell before they even got off the ground, right? Where by trying
us so far.
Well, the United States is in a unique position in that it's the global reserve currency, yeah, backed by the petrodollar.
Got and a little tax more gas on it.
Yeah, as long as that system was running, we could do that ad infinitum. But what non-national digital money has opened the door to is that even the United States, in attempting to do so, will be burying itself, essentially, right? We'll be making its currency turn to dust, because everyone will realize, like, oh, that's a problem. You know, for example, we just printed more money in the past 2 months than in all of the history of the United States. That's a problem, right? So there's enough rational human beings to start exiting that economy. And that used to be very difficult, but now it's just installing an app and buying crypto. Right? That you're shorting US dollars when you do that, right? So yep. I think more and more people are going to grok to that. I think, you know, right now the last data I saw was that 50% of Americans are interested in buying Bitcoin right now. And that's the highest it's ever been by like a huge margin. That means we're past the 23 to 25% tipping point.
Yep.
Any cultural phenomenon that passes that point never turns around, right? Yep. The adoption curve, we're in that hockey puck stage where like the adoption curve is just screaming upwards. We've been talking about it for multiple market cycles, and it's here. And I think that is just the tip of the iceberg. I think that the beginning of non-national digital money is not the end of non-national digital money, right? That the possibilities are just beginning. And I think we're going to see some really interesting, like, ethos-led economies that really, really transform our economic landscape.
Do you think there will be like projects that sort of try to break off and sort of, like you said, run their own sort of economies? Maybe it's, you know, group of people break away in Utah or they're up in, you know, Canada. Yeah. Do you think that's going to
start happening? I think it's community-based. I think it's going to be regional, like I said, a fractal. So what you'll have is local independence where you could create your own economies, essentially your own IOU units that are being managed in your small, maybe it's your family, maybe it's an eco-village, maybe it's the town. And at the same time, we'll be in this much larger economy that it's completely compatible with, but buoyed against, right? And most of Anatha's designs are around that. That's one of the reasons we built in the Cosmos ecosystem, because essentially what you just described was a small hub, right? So like, how many hubs can you have? As many as you want, right? You could essentially have your own economy that is completely interoperable and fluid with another economy without losing the advantages of either, right? And yeah. I think we're going to have a much more fluid and adaptive economic environment. And I think that's important. Like, adaptation as a species is very important. And we need to not repeat the mistakes of the past and just be like, well, there's going to be one global reserve currency, right? Like, my thing with maximalists has always been, it's like you joined a movement about decentralization and then thought everything was going to be about one thing, right? It's a little wonky, right? So yeah. I think things are going to get more distributed at the meta level, right? Distributed thinking doesn't just stop at the blockchain. It has to also be permeated through your entire systems design. And I think what you just described is a form of distributed thinking, in that we'll have a local economy and a regional economy and a national economy and a global economy and many economies inside of that. And that at any time that any of these economies are not doing what we want them to do, that they're not aligning with our deepest held purpose or deepest held belief, for example, like one of them is starting a war, that we'll just short the economy. We'll remove our power from that economy and move it into the others. Because I think the important thing to remember, it's people that are important, not the economy, not the unit of account. And we could just short the hell out of any unit of account that we disagree with, right? And mm-hmm. I think that's what's going to happen naturally. I think we're going to become a much more adaptive species as a result. And we're just going to move past this idea of like a single nation state economy with 13 guys sitting in a room determining our fates. I think that's just, people are in the past are going to be like, why did you let them do that? Right? Why would you, like, it's going to be one of those things, right? It's,
So do you think like things like universal healthcare or other rights are going to start being bundled in? Do you think it's better just to have a flat amount of cash and let people sort of decide at that point? You know, what's your philosophy?
I think there'll be insurance-based economies, health insurance-based economies. I think there'll be like economic ecosystems in which your inclusion in a large insurance plan is just part of you being there, right? Just like by giving it your inputs, a percentage of all of it is always going to pay towards this list of things that you've chosen. And if that's not the case, you'll either try to vote it in or you'll find one in which you can vote it in, right? So yeah, I think we will have economies that have insurance programs built in. And in fact, I could tell you, I know we will, because I'm working on two of them, right? There's two insurance companies that have come to me and said, how do we do distributed insurance? And I said, well, first off, you don't want to just be an insurance project. What you want to do is build an economy. And one of the redeemable things you could get with the unit of account is insurance. Right. And they grok to that. And that's definitely going to happen. Right. Now, again, I think we'll sort of have this fractal effect where I might sort of be in that economy, but I'm not all the way in that economy. Right. I'm also in this one and this one. And I think we'll be much more diversified moving forward. The hard part is going to be building the tools to help you manage that level of complexity. And again, that's part of what Anatha's vision is we're building an Omni wallet that's going to have these sort of smart tools built in to help you navigate that. But I believe we're just at the beginning of that phase. That's going to be very difficult for most people. And it may be another generation or two before we really get it. We're going to make a lot of mistakes between now and then, but I think on a long enough time scale, what you described, you know, insurance, whether it's health insurance, life insurance, even housing and food insurance necessarily, like all your needs, everything on Maslow's chart essentially will likely be accounted for by these economies, because that's what we want, right? Yeah. Like the thing, whatever human beings want their economies to do, I think we'll get economies that do that thing, right?
So, yeah, no, absolutely. Do you think like, you know, have you looked at all to, you know, Asian countries, places like South Korea, Japan, where they seem to be, you know, 5-10 years ahead of us on some of this, and companies are rewarding their customers in ways that, you know, we haven't really thought of. Have you looked to them at all?
Yeah, I mean, most of my clients are in Southeast Asia. In fact, I have a whole Korean arm. You know, we have some advisors over there. I have like an uncle Chunsik who takes me around Seoul and introduces me all the potential clients we have every year. Yeah, I think they're in some ways they're ahead, and in some ways they're behind. I think from the American markets, we'll see more innovation. American and European markets seem way more inclined to try to create like radical things and deploy them. But in terms of just technology adoption, the South Asian markets are much faster, right? They're way more keen to just like pick things up. So I think we'll still see some really interesting like, for example, I'm seeing a gold-backed cryptocurrency project out of Thailand, but the one I'm more excited about is porting over my social media project into South Korea with a strategic partner there. And whether or not these things like catch on like wildfire, you often don't know, because Southeast Asia in particular is very like fad-based. One of my business partners there owns the largest influencer network in Thailand, for example. And I'm still amazed by the fact that he could just push a button and sell 70,000 tickets for a boy band, right? Like, they basically have like K-pop bands that are the most popular thing in the world. Yeah. And I think it just takes that kind of leverage and that kind of positioning for a project to succeed. So I'm certainly going to be pushing that over the next 2 to 3 years. But whether or not they actually get ahead, I don't know, right? I think, again, it'll be a very individual thing. I think that's one of the advantages of the internet and distributed nation states, is that the future doesn't show up everywhere at once. It just kind of shows up for you whenever you decide to invite yourself in. And yes, we'll see lots of people in Southeast Asia jumping in, but the thing that I've seen more in European and American markets is people who are willing to do like ethos-led stuff, right? Where like impact investing or moving towards things because they believe in it, versus just like looking at it as like a financial instrument. Most of the people I talk to in Southeast Asia, not all of them, but most, are looking at it like a financial play, right? It's purely finance to them. So, and I think that will change in time though.
Yeah, no, I definitely, we've had very similar experiences, I'd say. I think finding, and that's, you know, that's part of the, part of crypto is it's so great having these broad investor bases of just regular people who can be involved without having to go to the top rungs and get the approval of the people who have everything to lose if the system does actually work. Have you had some experience with that? Have you, you know, run up against some walls of people who just seem to not want this to happen?
Oh, I mean, I spent the first maybe 3 or 4 years of my life, of my career, just my crypto career, just being laughed out of every room I went into. Right? Where they're saying, that's nice, kid. You created non-national digital money. Now shoo. Like they just didn't think it was real. They didn't think it was possible. Most thought it would be illegal, right? They thought that was like one of the, you're not allowed to create your own money, right? And it turns out it doesn't matter if you're allowed or not, because they can't stop it.
You'd think they wouldn't want you to, right?
All right. I mean, you know, they don't want you to, but you know, it's like whether or not it's a question, it's not a question of legality. It's a question of the laws of physics, right? Distributed systems don't really care about regional laws, right? They just exist. And unless you feel like shutting down all the electricity and internet in your region, they're going to continue to exist. So you just have to make peace with it as a regulator. And I think, have I run into some resistance though? Yes, but less every year. And not just in terms of like the wider market, but also just individually for myself, as my own ability to express what this is really about has improved, and also just the background information. Like I used to have to go in and explain what Bitcoin was, right? I'd have to be like, why it can't be shut down. And I'd spend
Bitcoin is different than blockchain. Yeah.
that was year three, right? The first 3 years was that there's this thing called Bitcoin and that it's on something called a blockchain. And these are the reasons and the properties or the sort of emergent qualities of that system that make it important and why you should care. And then they would spend the next 14 weeks just trying to wrap their head around that. And then we could talk about what was next. And where I was already trying to build everything I'm trying to build now, or everything I have built now, I knew I wanted to build in 2013.
Yep.
I had to spend the next 7 years explaining it to people. And it was only after, 3 or 4 years of doing that people started to say, okay, let's put some money behind it. Let's get in there. And I've been very fortunate, and I've been able to raise capital to position myself. And every year that has gone by, that has gotten easier. I'm in talks with some really exciting strategic partners right now, two of which are central banks in Europe that are basically saying, don't worry about money. They're like, your money's handled. Yeah, just tell me what you can do, right? That is a new development that literally is something that has just emerged this business quarter, right? So, I think every day that goes by, that gets a little bit easier. I think there's always going to be resistance. And the higher you go, that the weirder the resistance gets and the less rational it gets, right? Yeah. What they're really trying to do is just hold on.
Yeah.
Hold on for your
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely. So what can the average person do to get involved with Anatha right now? What's your sort of, are you acquiring customers? What stage are you at?
We're just at the point where we're onboarding our early community. The easiest thing is join the Telegram group, start having a chat, and figure out if you even fit in, right? like don't join a community and then realize like, oh, I hate all these people. This is not about me. But you could go onto Uniswap and you could participate in our liquidity pool. We're going to have a liquidity pool rewards program spool up this quarter. That'll be pretty exciting. our big sale starts next year, Q1, where people will be able to just go to a dashboard and buy an ATHA directly, right? You could use fiat currency or crypto to buy it, and we're going to make it very simple and very easy. But at this point, you know, we're really looking for the diehards, the people who are a little bit more sophisticated, who might want to run a validator, who have input. We're very community focused, and I believe in the power of open source and collective intelligence. So I really listen to people when they come to me and they say like, oh, these are some ideas I want to share. I don't just brush them off. I really have the topic and I'll dive in with you. So like, by all means, like join our Telegram group. Let's have the chat. Let's kick the ball around and see if we can't make this thing better. Right. And that's fun for me. And I think we should all really participate that. And if a community wasn't doing that, like if a project wasn't going to listen to my inputs, I would just go find another project. So, you know, I'm just kind of inviting the door and saying, hey, come on in. Let's have the chat. It's fun. Right. This is what we're passionate about. This is what we believe in. But the other things that you could do is, you know, you could download the app. You could register an HRA. In order to register an HRA right now, you need an ATHA. So just come bother me and I'll give you some. Right? So getting a human readable address is really cool. It happened the other day for like the first time. One of my business partners, Jeff, he was like, I need to send you something. He was like, can you go send me your address? I was like, you don't need to. It's at CEO.
Yeah,
I just knew it, right? Yeah. Like, when has that ever happened with cryptocurrency, yeah, right? I just know my cryptocurrency address, right?
Yeah, that's been such a big problem, honestly.
Yeah, so we're kind of trying to make that transition the way email made that transition in the early 90s, where it used to be a long string and then it turned into human readable addresses. So
yeah,
that was one of the main features and functions we wanted to start off with, and that's what our currency is ultimately backed by. It's backed by that name registry that allows you to have that name. So, you know, that was another useful thing. I think name registries are important. You know, at CEO is obviously a really good thing to have. And I'm really glad that I have that, right? But I won't have it forever because it's on a subscription basis. I need to keep burning currency to keep it. So gotcha. I think we've thought this through pretty well. And I think, you know, we've seen other name registries and we're perfectly open to being compatible with them. But I think some of them were a little weird in that, like, you needed like lots of fiat currency to own a name forever. Mm-hmm. It's like, that didn't really make sense to me. If you're going to build in a crypto economy, then you should back it with crypto, right? You should make it fully crypto. So yeah, that's one of the things that we did that I'm really happy with. And it's just the tip of the iceberg though, right? So if you want to join now though, join the Telegram community and come bother me for some Anatha and we'll get your human readable address. And the best thing you could do to help out is just use your brain and contribute, right? That's so valuable.
That all sounds great. I'm definitely going to hop on, chat with you on there. That sounds like a fun time. And I think the human readable addresses are a huge thing because everyone has a nightmare with private keys. They don't understand it. It's too much work. They lose it. It's terrifying to people. So I think that's something that really needs to come to fruition. And it's a perfect way to sort of integrate Web3 with all of this other stuff.
Yeah, we're trying to go even further too. Like, yes, human readable addresses are great, but we also needed to make it omniversal. So we needed an Omni wallet, right? So it's not just like I have a human readable address that's good with Bitcoin. Yep. It's like, no, I have a human readable address that's good with the whole market is really what you want, right? And we went even further to make that human readable address an identifier in an ecosystem. So for the first time, and hopefully that's ready this quarter, I'll be able to chat to a cryptocurrency address. So like before I send you money, I could say, hey, is this you, Mark?
Yeah.
Mark, what, you know, tell me who I am. What do you know about me, right? Like, what's, you know, like we have a chat.
Yeah.
And in doing so, I realize I'm sending the money to the right place. And just as importantly, we could have private communications, right? Because it's still being powered by the same technology. There's a lot of things that emerge, you know, just from having an identifier like that I could trust. Like, you, if you know I'm at CEO and you know that the only person who controls that CEO is the same person who controls the private keys to all those finances, you could reasonably expect that to be me, right?
Yeah.
And so now we could have a conversation and we could create social media environments that are tokenized and granular. We have referral systems, auto affiliate systems, all this stuff already built, by the way, just deploying in stages. That I think are going to give us a robust market advantage, but also just our users, you know, tremendous advantage and allow them to unpack value in a way that other markets don't really do right now. You know, I love like that Ethereum is going to staking and I love that all these other ecosystems have these ways of making money, but they still feel limited to me as a, like, as just like a normal power user. Like, what can I do to do anything? You know, my way in was to do journalism. I did the same thing Vitalik did at the same time too, where we were just working as journalists. And we were monetizing our research and getting paid in crypto, which is what I recommend like anyone do. Yep. If you don't know your way in, just become a journalist and write and research, right? It's a great way to monetize your own like efforts. But I want to be able to join an ecosystem in which the things that the ecosystem needs, like onboarding other users, are incentivized directly with the network, right? Like if every time you brought someone to the Ethereum ecosystem, it paid you to do so, I think that would be really good for both of those parties, right? For the network and you. And that's part of what I call self-propagating systems. So I built a few of those into Anatha. And I think in 2021, when they're like fully deployed and integrated into our user interface, that we're going to see exactly how right I, or wrong, right, I was about the importance of self-propagating systems. But just on the surface, I know that it's a sound idea. And we saw some examples of it. I think the one that most people bring to mind is Initiative Q, where they just had like this good interface with this little referral system. And next thing you know, it's everywhere. Yeah. I think we could do the same thing for an actual crypto project that's already in the market. And I think that's way more exciting.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned them. I remember them so clearly. I have no idea what they've done since, but they
Nothing.
Did great.
Still there. I check on them every now and then. I have over a million. They owe me over a million Q. I'm like, what is it worth? I don't know.
That's the problem. Well, that's super interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I encourage all the listeners to go and check it out. I think it's just anatha.io. Is that right?
Anatha.io, or you can join our Telegram group. You can join the Telegram group, which you just search for Project Anatha and Telegram, and we'll pop up. There's a couple different languages, so depending on what language you read, but I'm usually in the English one, you know, hanging out and just kind of helping people understand what we're doing and doing my best to just let everyone understand that, like, we mean all the stuff we say and that we're really doing these things, right? It's authentic for us, so.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys for listening, and thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it, and I encourage everyone to go check out Anatha.
Aloha, Mark. Thank you so much for your time. Have a good one.
Thank you. You too.